We're back. This is the second hour of the Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. The Interpreter Foundation is an organization formed to defend the LDS faith, to do scholarship and research on scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and to do other faith-promoting works, including, as we have talked about last hour, discussing a recent film project dealing with Book of Mormon witnesses. During this segment, during this hour of our program, we are discussing Come Follow Me lesson on sections 23 through 26. The theme of this lesson is strengthening the members of the church, strengthening the church. And I've always, Dan, been fascinated with these sections of the Doctrine and Covenants, because these are at least somewhat unique. As you think about Old Testament and New Testament scriptures generally found in Christianity, do you have stuff that's just addressed to an individual? Well, yeah, some of Paul's stuff. You know, you've got Timothy and Titus, right, and they're pretty directed. And you've got some very pointed statements here and there in the Old and New Testament directed to individuals. But they're still not quite like this.
Right.
This is pretty unique and a little bit different.
Yeah. You know, I think the Doctrine and Covenants, one of the things that makes it fun is you see what I think may be the sort of thing that would be the raw materials for some of the other scriptural books, like Chronicles and so on. Somebody has written those based on correspondence in the court and, you know, little snippets of information here and there, and put them together into a narrative. But here you have the raw material. This is the historical data as it's happening in real time. So it's kind of fun. And when you talk about strengthening the churches, I mean, here we are. We're talking about mid-1830. The church isn't all that big. We're talking about a few dozen people, maybe. This is at the very, very beginning. It only started with six official members on April 6th. Of 1830.
Yeah. So. I've heard estimates that, you know, 50-ish, give or take 10 or so,
yeah,
somewhere in that range, and that's about right. Two comments. The first one is that in this context, with so few people and in such a new organization, here you are. I mean, COVID's been around now a lot longer than the church.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's just, and here, I'm not sure that was a great analogy or not, but the point is that this is so new and so fresh. People are caught up with the belief in the new faith. And the miraculous part of it for me is, among other things, these wonderful pronouncements that you have, and some of those have been explored in previous lessons about a marvelous work and a wonder. It isn't, well, we got this new organization, let's kind of see what we can do until we build things up. You know, I mean, that's kind of what you'd find in a business context. No, this is a marvelous work. This is a wonder. This is a phenomenal thing. This is amazing. And in that context, these sections 23 through 26 of the Doctrine and Covenants are faithful adherence to this new restoration faith. Close associates of Joseph Smith,
yeah,
who are coming to him saying, please find out what God's will is for us. Give us something, if you could, it's inspired by God to direct us, and hence we have these sections.
You know, I thought today, with the church being so much larger, incomparably larger, imagine these people looking forward to seeing what the church is today. They would have been astonished. In some ways, not astonished, but in other ways, blown away by it. There weren't that many people within 500 miles of them, you know, all totaled. But a lot of these sections, these revelations here are the kind of thing that we get now, maybe, for example, in patriarchal blessings. It's individual revelation, in a sense, individual scripture for us. But in the church as a whole, it can't. You simply can't have the president of the church receiving a revelation for every individual member about what he or she ought to be doing right now, today, tomorrow. And so, you know, so that's kind of turned into a localized phenomenon. You go to the patriarch, and he gives you this sort of information about what you ought to be doing and what you can look forward to. But, you know, one thing that struck me in reading this, it occurred to me, and I'm not sure I'd thought of it really before, but in section 24, verse 3, where it says, you should go speedily unto the church which is in Colesville, Fayette, and Manchester. Those are the three centers. And basically, we know who they are. Colesville, it's the Knight family. Fayette is the Whitmer family. And Manchester is the Smith family. Give or take a few individuals. That's about it. That's what you've got. That's where the church begins. Colesville has been described sometimes as the first organized branch of the church, which is basically the Knight family. But there are three families, extended families, not very big extended families, and that's it. I'm pleased. I'll mention it now because this doesn't really count all that much for me, but I'm a descendant of Joseph Knight Sr. And I remember when I first found that out, I had been on a mission with a person who was a descendant of George Q. Cannon. And he knew every relative he had to the, you know, fourth cousin, 17 times removed level and all that sort of thing. And I kept thinking, man, I come from nobody, you know. As a missionary, I think I held the highest office ever held by anyone in my family. And some of them were, you know, populating jails in parts of southern Utah. And we had, you know, not the most distinguished LDS line. And then when I discovered that I was descended from Joseph Knight Jr., Joseph Knight Sr., I thought to myself, good grief, we go back before there was a church. You know? Now, what does that matter? It doesn't matter at all. You know, God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. But nevertheless, it was kind of fun to find that I had a connection with these really, really early members. It was tenuous. The family didn't always keep its end of the bargain up. In the generations leading up to me, but we had that link.
Which is fascinating. I know a little bit about Joseph Knight Sr. As I recall, he was the Universalist before he joined the church, and so he probably would have had some fairly liberal ideas about Christianity and, you know, and prayer and religion in general, and this would have been a pretty significant change for him to join the faith.
Yeah, I think it was. But, oh, he was committed. You know, the Knight family has been called the second family of the Restoration. Once they were converted, they were absolutely faithful.
Let's talk about some of the details here in section 23. One of the fascinating ones is about taking up your cross.
Yeah.
And some people in the church find that a little bit odd because we don't particularly, you know, worship the cross or focus in on somehow the crucifixion. Our emphasis is on the resurrection. But the meaning here is a little bit different. This is kind of a metaphor for, you know, bearing a heavy cross or some kind of challenge or difficulty or trial or something that's maybe worthwhile but isn't easy.
And I think that's consistent with our unwillingness to glorify the cross.
Yes.
We see the cross as a negative thing. And it was an instrument used to torture the Son of God, but he defeated it. So for us, if you could do a symbol of an empty tomb, that would be more like it. Or now the symbol we do use is the resurrected Christ welcoming all with his arms extended as of, you know, just a year or so ago that was established as the church symbol. It's the risen Christ, not the suffering crucified Christ that is our symbol. important as the crucifixion of the atonement are, he defeated death, he defeated sin. So it's used here negatively, take up your cross. In other words, it's a burden.
It is a burden. But I've often seen this in the context of there must needs be opposition in all things. It's not, well, there kind of might be, or there could be a few that you run across. Well, there has to be in this whole idea of opposition and taking up your cross is bear those things that you're challenged with well, because they have to be there. They're for your good. People typically grow more when they encounter difficulties than when it's a bed of roses and you have grapes to pop in your mouth. You know, that kind of
thing. You know, when I was serving as a bishop, I was a bishop in a young single adults ward. And sometimes people would come in and they had horrible stories. I mean, they were terrible stories. I had kids in my ward who were literally orphans. They needed financial help. And the state president would say, well, be sure they go to their family first. And I said, their family are dead. Literally, they're dead. Or in a couple of cases, the mother and father are both in prison. You know, but there were a lot of stories that were tough. And there were times when I'd tell them, you know, look, I'm sorry. I mean, words are cheap. I say to you, I'm so sorry that you're facing this. And you've got to face it. We can help you in some regards, but you've got a tough row to hoe. But then I said, remember that you can react to this in two ways. You can become bitter and throw up your hands, surrender, whatever. Or you can resist it and overcome it. And it's easy for me to say, because you're the one that's going to have to do it. But I said, if you went to the gym, would you want to work out with quarter-pound weights? You know? Take up a bar and do curls, arm curls with a 2 ounce bar. You wouldn't. I mean, resistance is what builds strength. It's pushing against something. It's if you're swimming or running, it's trying to go a little faster than you did before. And does it hurt? Yeah, it does, but it gives you greater capacity. Again, talk is cheap. I can say that to you, and I all I can do is express sympathy, but resistance is what this life is about, and it's always there. Nobody gets out of here. If you ask anybody, you can look at people and think, oh, they've led a charmed life. They've had no problems at all. No, they always have. If you knew the story, you'd know there are things they had to deal with in their family or health-wise or any number of things. And that's what makes us what we are.
There's this short little verse, 23:3, that's directed to Hiram Smith, and it says, "Wherefore thy duty is unto, wherefore thy duty is unto the church forever, and this because of thy family, amen." And I've looked at that and tried to see it from the perspective at the time it was given, because when you look back, you say, "Oh, Hiram Smith." Church patriarch, great things to come.
Yeah.
At the time, he might have been kind of scratching his head thinking, duty to the church forever because of your family?
Yeah.
How does that really work? But I think over time, the real import of those words would have been made clear. But it probably wasn't at the time. I certainly wouldn't have understood it.
No, I don't think any of them could have understood at that point what this would entail. It's like the fishermen on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, come follow me. Did they really know what they were getting into? I've sometimes wondered about Joseph Smith. Did he ever think back and say, you know, when I went into that grove, I just wanted to know, should I be a Methodist or a Presbyterian? I didn't expect
and
this.
And can my sins be forgiven? Yeah. And those were the two biggies.
Right.
Yeah.
And now look what's happened. Maybe I shouldn't have asked. But, you know, I've had that experience sometimes where people have told me, you shouldn't have raised this issue. But now that you have, and then they unload on you something much more than you expected. But, yeah, I'm thinking, could you have imagined in 1830 your duty is with the church forever because of your family? But, in fact, it was. His life revolved around the church. And, frankly, his family has continued to be that way. It's his descendants, not Joseph's, who've been presidents of the church, members of the 12, and so on.
Very, very true. The Joseph Smith side of the Smith family have recently become more involved, but that's more recent.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very good point. Great point. What else would you like to say about Section 23, if anything, before we jump to Section 24?
Well, there's so much to talk about in these, but I think it's interesting that when Oliver is addressed, he's told to beware of pride. And I'm not in a position to judge Oliver. I mean, Oliver was called to be one of the three witnesses. I was not. You know, and Oliver helped to choose the first 12 apostles. I wasn't asked to do that. So it's not for me to look down on Oliver. But I look at him and I think, was pride a factor when he finally did have his falling out with Joseph? He had a hard time sometimes, I think, saying, well, how come Joseph is the leader, even when I don't agree with him necessarily? I mean, I stood in the presence of Peter, James, and John. I stood in the presence of John the Baptist. I helped translate the Book of Mormon. And yet he's the leader and I'm not. And I think there came a time when Oliver was chafing under that authority. He didn't agree. He didn't like what Joseph was doing. Now, the ideal would have been to submit, but it was that's easier said than done. And he was the second elder of the church. So I wonder if pride, if this wasn't prophetic in a very real way in terms of telling the future.
I've always looked back and not forward. I like your looking forward. When I read about the pride being an issue, I think to the efforts to translate. And, oh, you took no thought, save it was to, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the gist of it is you just thought it would happen automatically. You didn't put real effort into this. That kind of has a little bit of a sense of pride attached to it, or at least that's kind of the way I've seen it. Maybe that's not being in his place.
But. You know, I think he was better educated, marginally, but better educated than Joseph Smith. Joseph, I think, was very aware of the fact that he couldn't write. He wanted a scribe, and I can't imagine that it didn't sometimes enter into all of his mind, I'm the guy here with the better education. I'm a school teacher. He's a farmer. Why am I not at least equal with him?
Fascinating comment, and certainly one that had Oliver taken perhaps a little greater to heart. Things might have been a little different, but still fascinating statement. Other comments about Section 23?
Oh, I think we can go on to 24.
24.
I do like the fact that it's Joseph Knight's duty to unite with the true church. He hasn't done it yet. He's been on the fringes. I mean, he just hasn't literally taken the plunge. But the Lord is saying, okay, it's time.
Time to join.
Yep.
Time to actually formally join.
Commit.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Great point. Section 24, during April of 1830, Joseph Smith spends a lot of time at the Knight place in Colesville, and the Knights are listening to Joseph Smith's message, and a lot of things happen. There's opposition. There are people who are trying to present or prevent baptisms, but people do join the church. And after Joseph returns from Colesville to Harmony, then we have this revelation or inspiration that we know now as Section 24. And sort of the theme of this is declare the gospel like the voice of a trumpet. I mean, just proclaim it loudly in essence. And this, I think, is fascinating because of the whole context. This is the time frame when Joseph Smith hauled into court. There were all kinds of difficulties that were going on, persecutions there, and instead of, well, let's hunker down and weather the storm, it's let's declare the gospel with the voice of a trumpet as if from an angel. I've, again, been astounded at how unlikely that would be without inspiration.
Yeah. Well, and it was tough. I mean, Harmony never does become a center of the church, except that Joseph is there. But they don't develop a huge congregation. That's where Isaac Hale lives, his father-in-law, and even he doesn't like him much. couple of the sons of Isaac Hale, who are scribes for the Book of Mormon, never joined the church. It's not very receptive soil. But even there, they're supposed to proclaim the gospel and to continue calling upon God's name, upon God in my name. It says Jesus' name. And you'll be given words. It shall be given thee in the very moment what thou shalt speak and write. And they shall hear it, or I will send unto them a cursing instead of a blessing. Now, that's aimed especially at the people in Fayette and Manchester and in Colesville. But also I expect it's given in Harmony. And Harmony, well, I don't know how many people out there have been to Harmony. It's hard to find in a way. There is no Harmony anymore. It's Nineveh. Which is really interesting, by the way, as a replacement for the name.
Yeah.
But Harmony Township is effectively no more. There's no Harmony Town. If you look for it on a map, you won't find it. It's easy to get to once you figure out what's going on. And by the way, let me say, the church's visitors center there, which is quite new, dedicated by Elder Russell M. Nelson not long before he became president of the church, is one of the finest visitors centers in the church. Historically, it's just really well done. So it's a bit out of the way, but extremely worthwhile.
Worth going to. That's a great tip. I had no idea.
No.
Another tidbit for the background of Section 24 is this would have been just prior to the time that the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthoods were restored, and the allusion that I made earlier to legal difficulties, at least according to second and third hand sources, were in connection with the restoration of the Melchizedek priesthood, which is a story that's not widely known. But despite the difficulties in the background that were going on, the church is progressing. Mm-hmm. The priesthood's restored. People are joining the church, and this Revelation section 24 happens, telling people to proclaim the gospel.
Right, right. There's another interesting thing here that strikes me. This is given to Joseph Smith. It says, verse 7, "For thou shalt devote all thy service in Zion, and in this thou shalt have strength." But then go down to verse 9, "And in temporal labors thou shalt not have strength, for this is not thy calling. Attend to thy calling, and thou shalt have wherewith to magnify thine office." That is, if you attend to your responsibilities, you'll have enough that you'll survive. But temporal things are not your strength. And that's absolutely true over Joseph's life. Now, if I were to contrast him with Brigham Young, there are lots of ways of contrasting him. Brigham had a gift for practical management, administration, that sort of thing, that I think Joseph didn't. And I don't mean to badmouth Joseph, but I thought to myself, could Joseph have led the trek westward? I'm not sure. Brigham Young did magnificently. Was this Joseph's wheelhouse? I don't think it was. Brigham used to laugh that they set Joseph up with a shop in Nauvoo. He just gave it all away. People would come in and give him a sob story and say, it's okay, take the stuff, you know. No need to pay, you can pay me later. And of course they didn't. And Brigham said that Joseph was a terrible businessman in that regard. And partly because of who he was, people would come in and say, if he doesn't give me this flour for nothing, he's no prophet of God. And so Joseph would give it to them. But he wasn't a great businessman. He never became rich. Some people have said he went into this line of work, prophecy, you know, to become rich. If he did, he was a miserable failure at it.
Yeah, the critics have always astounded me on this because I've often said, "Oh yeah, I remember that letter that Joseph sent to Oliver that said, gee, if we can sell more of these books of Mormons, we're just going to get rich." But there's no such letter.
No.
There is no such letter. As a matter of fact, I have, because early on in my dealings with the critics of the church, this kind of thing had been brought up. I thought, well, let's keep looking. And I've always kept my eye out for anything that might even remotely look like some kind of a profit motive,
right,
or an expectation of wealth. You can scour the Joseph Smith papers. It is not there. You can scour third party comments about Joseph Smith from people who he actually knew, not critics who threw rocks at him. You cannot find it. It is not there.
No. No, the evidence from his papers, I think one of the great contributions of the Joseph Smith papers is as you read his letters and so on from very early on, if this guy was not sincere, then I'm a leprechaun. I mean, it's transparent on every page. Yeah. He believes it. You can just reading those letters, you might conclude, well, he's sincere but crazy. If you don't want to believe him. But you can't conclude he's insincere. There's not one trace of it, even in the most private letters to his wife and his children and descriptions of what he does. He's really upset at one point, so he goes into the woods to pray, which indicates to you this is the kind of thing Joseph did, not just in the first vision story. When he was troubled by something, he'd go into a private place in the woods and pray. He does this all the time. And there are prayers in his letters. Oh God, bless thy servant. You know, bless his family. Help me to do this and this and this. And he's transparently sincere. That's why, by the way, that I think the plates are so significant. Because if I don't want to believe Joseph, I have two basic choices. He's either not sincere, and he's cheating, or he's crazy.
Right. Well, he's either crazy or a conscious fraud.
Right.
And neither
right.
one of those work.
They don't work. I mean, I remember a certain critic, my late lamented friend Bill Hamblin, tried to pin him down one day. He said, okay, let's assume, as you say, there were no plates. Did Joseph know there were no plates, or did he think there were plates? And the fellow knew he was cornered, and he said, yeah, I'm not going to lower myself to your simplistic dichotomies. But that's the real question. To me, Joseph's sincerity is clear, and the fact that there were plates seems to take craziness off the table, too. There really is something there. It's not just pure, subjective, nutcake stuff. And he gets nothing out of this, except a shortened life and substantial time in prison under miserable conditions and mob violence and tarring and feathering. Anyway.
I used to have a critic call on the show that I did, and I used to ask him that very thing. All right, so what was Joseph's motivation? And that's the problem when they come up with these different theories. It's a paper tiger. There's nothing behind it. You just can't substantiate it. And Joseph Smith, this is the reason why when people come up with critical comments or unvirtuous claims about Joseph Smith, I instantly do not believe them, even if I will look into them, because I know his personality. Yeah. I have seen so much that it would be impossible for me to believe that he is just a bad guy. It's just not possible. That's not who he was.
Can I tell you a little story about this? I was involved years ago. Some will remember the case of Elizabeth Smart and Brian David Mitchell. And I was retained by the federal prosecutors to be an expert witness in Brian David Mitchell's competency hearing and then a year later in his trial. And before the competency hearing, I remember the federal attorney calling me up just to kind of go over some last-minute things before I testified. But he's a good member of the church. He's very interested, more than usually interested in church history and so on. And he said, you know, I've been involved in the prosecution of a number of, quote, prophets, end quote, the Lafferty brothers and people like that. And he said, now with Brian David Mitchell, he says, you've been studying his writing and studying his life to help us out on this trial. He says, can you think of any case where Brian David Mitchell ever did anything for anybody else? And I said, no, curiously, I can't. Now, he said, just tonight, to kind of relax myself, I've been reading an account of Joseph Smith taking care of Brigham Young when Brigham had a fever. And Joseph is mopping Brigham's forehead and, you know, tending to him and bringing him drinks and that kind of thing, really devoting a lot of attention to him. He says, I can't remember anybody of these people I've prosecuted ever doing anything like that for another soul. And he says, they all want to be Joseph Smith, but they will never be Joseph Smith, worlds without end, because they're not like him in that regard. Joseph wasn't in it for the main chance. He wasn't doing it to feather his nest.
He was a good, good, kind man.
Yeah.
That's a great observation, a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that. Section 24, let's pick out a few choice verses in 10 minutes or so,
okay,
or 15 that we have here.
Well, there's one passage that struck me, verses 13 and 14. It says, require not miracles.
Ah, the Oliver Cowdery.
Except I shall command you, except casting out devils, da, da, da. And these things ye shall not do, except it be required of you by them who desire it. In other words, I think the idea is, this isn't kind of a carnival show where we're going to do gratuitous miracles all the time. Yeah, don't believe the miracles have stopped. They haven't. But don't be showing off. And don't demand them. Don't demand signs. I mean, by this time, Oliver Cowdery's had a lot of really powerful signs. He holds the priesthood. He's the second elder of the church. But it's not something to be abused. That's what I take from those two passages.
Great, great comment. And that speaks to the way that the first elder and the second elder conducted themselves. They weren't flamboyant. Mm-hmm. They weren't out there trying to make a big show of things. And this was a commandment to keep things down on the basic level, to give service to others, to help people along, as you mentioned, that Joseph Smith was always doing for others.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great observation. Great observation.
And, just another one toward the end. Verse 18, thou shalt take no purse nor scrip, neither staves, neither two coats, for the church shall give unto thee in the very hour what thou needest for food and for raiment and for shoes and for money and for scrip. Now this is addressed to Oliver Cowdery, and he will eventually go on a very long mission later that year, but he's told, depend on the people. They'll help you out. We don't do this anymore because there are laws and so on that would get you arrested for vagrancy. But I have friends. I have a friend who served his mission years ago in New Zealand, and he talked about how wonderful it was to go without purse or scrip among the people and the miracles that happened, that people would step forward not knowing that you needed anything but offering you something, which was exactly what you needed, and offering you to stay in their place that night and so on. I'm not sure I would have enjoyed the experience, but in a way I kind of wish I'd had it in the past or something like that. But this, again, the idea was the church was, they were all kind of on the same level of poverty. And the church was going to have to come together and support these people that it's asking to go out and preach or to spend day after day translating. As their work was labor intensive. It took long days, night, morning until night, 6 days at least a week. You took any time off for preaching or translation or dictation and so on, you were losing money, and it's not like you had a big cushion. You'd need help. So,
a quick observation also in section 24, verse 15, I've over the years had a lot of questions about this. Leave a cursing?
Yeah.
What's going on here? Why would you do it? And I think this phrase curse or cursing has a bit more of a negative connotation than it should. And some will say, well, it's a curse. That's pretty negative. What's that? But the real purpose here is that if you keep the commandments, you will prosper spiritually and physically. And if you don't, and one of those would be rejecting the gospel, you're kind of less likely to prosper spiritually or physically. And that could be denoted as a curse, even though we wouldn't look at it, that curse has such a negative connotation. But the point is that there are natural consequences that flow from decisions, and this statement here in verse 15 acknowledges that people who reject the gospel just aren't quite going to have the blessings that someone who accepted it would.
Right, right.
I don't see it as any more significant than that.
No, I think that may well be what it is. I mean, the fact is that joining the church will change your life over time in ways that you did not foresee. They can be material or non-material. My father worried for years before he joined the church. I baptized him the night I was set apart as a missionary. But he had worried because he was the head of a business, a construction business, and to pay 10% off the top, that was a lot of money. He told me some years later, he said, you know, the funny thing is my business picked up. I've never missed the tithing. I made up my mind I was going to do it faithfully, and I never missed it. I've done better since I've been paying tithing. Now, he said, I didn't do it to do better, and I can't guarantee that happens in every case. But in mine, it did. Yeah. And I felt that, you know, stepping out, my words, but stepping out in faith, it worked. Or I think of a story that a friend of mine told me. He was down in Honduras. They were visiting the ruins at Copan, and a group of Latter-day Saint people checking out the archaeology down there. And they had a boy that was waiting on them every night at their hotel, serving them food in the restaurant. And his name was Moroni, something or other. And they said it didn't take a lot of deduction to conclude that this guy might be LDS. So they asked him, you know, are you a member of the church? Yes, I am. And they eventually got his story. His father had been the town drunk. And he said he found the missionaries, turned his life around. He was now the bishop. And he said, we owe everything to the church. The church changed our family completely. And so he says, I'm working here to save money for my mission. Well, needless to say, by the way, when they left, they gave him a huge tip. But you know, there was another case of a family whose life, the life of which had been turned around by accepting the gospel. It has those implications. By the same token, not living the standards can get you into trouble. We've all seen that, cases where we see people who make the wrong choices time after time after time, and it ends in ruin. Not always. It's not that simple. If it were that plain, it would be too obvious. But I was just down in St. George a couple of weeks ago and went to look at the graves of some of my ancestors. My grandmother, my grandfather, and the maternal side were there and so on. A bunch of cousins, some of whom had died fairly young, but I was happy to see they died in full fellowship. They were, you know, active and everything. But there was one who died very young, and I happen to know the story. He led a terrible life in some ways, did everything wrong he could do, was eventually stabbed to death by his wife. And I thought, you know, I knew him when he was a kid. You wouldn't have predicted that, but he just made wrong choices. I'm not going to say that's going to happen to everybody who leaves the church, but I just thought how his life would have been different if he'd taken a different path.
Yeah. Decisions have consequences.
Yes.
They do. Any other comments on section 24? Should we move to 25?
Oh, gosh. yeah, let's move to 25. 25's got some good things in it.
It does. I love this. Emma Smith is an elect lady.
Yes. Yeah.
And people occasionally will ask, oh, what's this elect stuff? Well, that's a great Christian word.
Yeah.
If you're Jewish, you're chosen.
Right.
If you're part of early Christianity, you're part of the elect,
yeah,
of God. And
yeah, the terms in which she's described are very high. I mean, she's also described as God's daughter, you know, and that's pretty remarkable. Now, it does say that all women who accept the gospel and so on are his daughters, but it's pretty strong language. She's praised in high terms. And I know it's fashionable in the church in some ways to look down on Emma. I think we need to resist that. She went through an enormous amount. We cannot really comprehend it. She was very supportive of Joseph in almost every way, and finally was just worn out. I think she just couldn't go any further.
Right, and it in some places, when you get to the time after Joseph Smith is killed,
yeah,
she's faced with the decision of do I support my children, or do I support the church. And for her, in some ways, especially with William, that was a little bit more of a real decision than a theoretical one. And she chose her family.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure that we can throw very many rocks at Emma Smith for supporting her family. That's a pretty good decision to make. And one of the things that's always strengthened that was that she was always seen as a good, wonderful person. She took care of her mother-in-law, and at the very end of her life, when she finally passes away, according to several different sources, she's seeing Joseph Smith, who's waiting there for her.
Yeah, yeah. And that wouldn't surprise me a bit. I don't feel comfortable judging any of these people. I wasn't chosen to play that sort of a role, so not for me to throw any stones. But she is she's described very highly, and all the evidence, by the way, is that Joseph held her in high, high esteem. I remember we talked earlier in the portion about the witnesses, about Richard Lloyd Anderson. One of the things that he argued, he did a collection of Joseph's letters to Emma, and they're just full of expressions of love. One of the things he pointed out was, we don't have any letters like that for any other woman. Some people have said, he turned his back on Emma and went after all these other women. You can bet that if there were a love letter from Joseph to some other woman, it would be passed down in most of these families as a treasure. There don't seem to be any.
Yeah.
Now, it's not that he didn't hold them in respect and, hold them in affection and so on, but he was devoted to Emma. And those who think he wasn't, I think, are misreading the evidence. He really was committed to her, and she was committed to him.
Another fascinating, yes, she was very committed to him, and even though they had their difficulties, she stood by him.
Yeah.
And I've always appreciated that. I've always appreciated that. Verse 11 talks about her being called to compile the first hymnal.
Yes.
And I have to say, the very first time I saw a replica of the original hymn book, I thought, she had way better eyes than I did.
Yeah.
So did the earth. This is like some
teeny tiny.
But if you look at the collection of hymns in there, those are wonderful hymns. That's great. And it speaks to the fact that even though at a very young age she had some real musical and spiritual insights here to be able to compile that. I've thought, who could you find that was her age in my neighborhood, in my ward, or wherever, and you say, okay, young lady, I'd like you to put together a collection of hymns.
Yeah.
How well would it turn out?
She can't go online and search them out.
Exactly. She does this and does a marvelous job with it.
Yeah, yeah, she does a really good job. I think it's striking that in verse 7 it says, thou shalt be ordained under his hand to expound scriptures and to exhort the church according as it shall be given thee by my Spirit. For he shall lay his hands upon thee, and thou shalt receive the Holy Ghost, and thy time shall be given to writing and to learning much. She's given a really important role in the church. Not just to be the dutiful housewife and mother of the prophet's children, but to take a leading role in thinking and teaching and writing and selecting the hymns. And, how important are the hymns? Some people have said to me, you're not Christian. I say, look, you want to know the devotional heart of the church? It's the hymnal that we sing. Well, back in the old days, some will remember we used to go to church and we'd sit on what were called pews in a chapel and that sort of thing. But we would sing. And those hymns become so familiar to us. If you've been around for a few years, somebody just has to start the melody and you know the words. Oh, you may falter on verse 3 or something, but if you're reminded of it, it'll come right back. You know these things. You know hundreds of lines of hymns. This is how, in one of the most important ways that doctrines are taught in the church. that ideas are conveyed in the church because we repeat them over and over and over again. They're teaching us what to believe, how to pray, how to feel about God, how to feel about suffering and so on, and opposition. That's actually at the heart. I mean, if you want to illustrate what Latter-day Saints actually believe, take people to our weekly sacrament meetings and let them look at what we're singing about, for one thing.
Years ago, I produced, put together a little radio show about LDS hymns as a window into church doctrine and belief. And it really is. If you look at the first hymnal that Emma Smith put together, that gives you a real sense for who the early members of the church were, and hopefully it still does today in our hymnals.
Well, one of the favorite things that I've seen done in the church has been done in my home ward. Not lately. Somebody decided for some reason that this wasn't a really good thing, but I loved it. Every year we'd have a hymn singing sacrament meeting where there were no speeches. People would just stand up, go up like a testimony meeting, and say what their favorite hymn was and why. We had a really good organist who could play anything.
You'd have to have one for that.
but they'd say, well, this really means a lot to me because, you know, when my mother was in her last days, this song really came to me. Or when I was a little child, I learned this one. It meant a huge amount to me. Or it comforted me in the death of my wife. Or, you know, and then we'd sing the first verse or a designated verse that someone would ask us to sing. I loved that because it was a window into the souls of those people. What hymn means most to you and why? And they were often wonderful hymns. I mean, some of my favorites. There are a few sort of clunkers that I don't like, but other people do, so what am I going to say?
Yeah, a few of them have gone the way of... You know, I could hum and mention a few verses,
right,
but I shan't. The Law of Common Consent, Section 26. People, I think, generally underestimate the importance of a sustaining vote in the church, and probably don't realize its historical and current import.
Yeah,
I think this first struck me when I was having a significant discussion with a fundamentalist Latter-day Saint, I guess is the best way to describe him. I don't know. And the idea was, oh, well, you know, all these doctrines of the church, you know, plural marriage and so on and so forth, they continued underground even though they were publicly denied because that was the will of the Lord, and there are all these people who are called to do all these things, but nobody knew about it. That violates this law of common consent, because this section says that nothing of significance in the church is to be done without the common consent of the people. And you just don't find that.
That's right.
In the fundamentalist arena. And frankly, you can't find it in our church because this is so, so very important that it happens at every general conference. And the people who I tell us to say, well, wait a minute, that's not true. It's not like you've got three candidates or something and you cast your vote for one. This is a little different system than we have in election laws, but it's still so very, very, very important because you have to have that common consent.
Yeah, it talks about consent. Not dissent, but consent. You can withhold your consent, I suppose, but the idea is you consent to something. If a congregation voted no on a person proposed for a leadership position, I'm sure the stake presidency, whoever was the relevant authority, would look at that very, very seriously. But it, you know, one thing that's important about it is when we raise our arm to the square, we are saying, I will support and sustain this person. We sustain. That means to uphold, to help, to not try to undercut. But the other thing that I think you were getting at is important, that There are no secret leaders in the church. If somebody comes to me and says, well, I was secretly ordained to do X, Y, and Z, I think my response would be, well, maybe you were, but that has nothing to do with me. I'm under no obligation to pay any attention to you, because in the church I belong to, it's all done by public common consent. When the president of the church dies, I know who the new president is when he's announced, and I raise my arm to the square to sustain him. And, you know, they can't say to me, well, the real president of the church is actually so-and-so living in Leverkin. Okay, if you know that, good on you, good for you. But I don't know that, and I don't believe it, and it doesn't fit the order of the church as the scriptures state.
As the scriptures state, and that, for me, has always been the problem with Lauren Woolley and other stories,
yeah.
And I won't go further into that. It's not important. But the other comment about common consent is that, to some extent, people don't see the importance of it as much, I think, because the church is so careful now that there's rarely a reason to... All right, those opposed, raise your hand. That's very rare to see that. But I remember stories from my father and from my grandfather, and I've seen a few negative votes here and there at odd times in my life, so that I know this is a real principle. And if there, for some reason, really needed to be a negative vote based on the inspiration of the congregation, that's acceptable and that would be good in the sight of the Lord. And that's why this section is here. But the church is very careful now, and so that's rarely seen.
But it needs to be taken really seriously. This is a serious, solemn act. You know, we call it a solemn assembly when a new president of the church is sustained. And it's a solemn, serious act that you should be doing consciously, not just going through the motions. You've probably heard the story, I love it, of J. Golden Kimball somewhere down in Springville or something. And he's doing the sustainings of church leaders, and he can tell it's a warm day, and half of them are asleep, and the hands are just kind of going up in a lazy way. They're not really paying attention. So without changing his tone of voice, you know, he supposedly says, and all those of you in favor of moving Mount Nebo from this side of Utah Lake to the other side of Utah Lake, please indicate by the usual sign. And about a quarter of the hands go up. Some are looking around a little confused. And so he's, all right, those of you who said yes, meet me tomorrow, 6 a.m., bring your shovels.
Expression of great faith to move mountains, apparently. That's a great story.
But, you know, he's felt they're just going through the motions. They're not thinking about what they're doing. They need to listen.
It's a very important thing. And another comment that I've heard is, well, when should somebody raise their hand in opposition? And it's not because you don't like someone, or it's not because you think maybe even somebody could have been better at the position, or, you know, something along those lines. You need to know something that's a disqualifier. If you actually happen to know something that would disqualify someone from service, that would be a reason to raise your hand.
Yeah, it's possible there's something that you know that maybe the stake president or the bishop doesn't know and ought to be informed. Then he can say, okay, well, that doesn't rise to the level, or that does. That's serious.
They can make a decision, and the availability of that action is there and should be understood by people.
But you're right. It's not a popularity contest. It's not saying, well, I think so-and-so would have been a much better bishop. That's not your business. You don't know what went into the calling. I mean, certainly when I was called as a bishop, I thought I could name you 50 people off the top of my head that would make better bishops than I would.
Right.
But,
Final comment from me here, Dan, and then anything you might have, and we'll wrap up our hour, is that I think one of the true showings of faith is when General Conference runs around and you're asked to, you know, sustain certain church leaders, and then it's – and all the other leaders is presently constituted.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, can I really raise? I don't know all of them. I don't right. have the time to do all my due diligence right. on all of those people. I couldn't even figure out all their names. If somebody yeah. gave me a day, it'd be tough. That's where the faith comes in yeah. and the support comes in. And only if you know of some disqualifying features should you raise your hand. And,
yeah.
and still, those kinds of requests for an approval, raising your hand, is appropriate.
Right.
And that's why, because you have faith in leaders and the inspiration of God.
Yeah, I know if I were calling someone and there was something that I should have known but didn't know, I would appreciate being told. I had a counselor when I was serving as a bishop who was just first rate. A guy named Chris Rotz, very bright, very bright. Not that that's necessarily relevant, but it helped. MIT all the way through to a PhD in every degree, very bright. And he would sit at my right hand in ward council meetings, and I'd start to make a decision. And he'd say, "Excuse me, Bishop, have you thought about this?" Well, the fact is, I hadn't. And then he was always so apologetic after the meeting. "Bishop, I didn't mean to challenge you. I don't want to seem to be complaining or, you know, disagreeing with you." And I said, "No, Chris, that's why I have counselors. If I'm about to do something stupid, I want you to catch me before I do it. I want to hear from you. I want input." And you know, don't want to overdo it. The bishop doesn't need a coalition going to him to tell him who to call as Relief Society president. You shouldn't call him right. as a teacher and that sort of thing. But if it's serious, yeah, then I'm sure a bishop would appreciate sure. it. They're human. They're mortal. They're limited and finite. We all are. And it would be helpful to them.
Right.
But and always being supportive.
Yes.
Trying to help.
And it's the entire church has inspiration,
yeah.
rights, and duties, not just the leaders. We
yeah.
don't blindly follow
right.
our leaders. Well, Dan, always a pleasure. Best of luck with the unveiling here at the LDS Film Festival,
yeah.
the Witness film. That'll
yeah.
be fabulous.
I'm looking forward to it.
And for those of you who have joined us, we hope you've enjoyed our Come Follow Me lesson here, and join us again on Interpreter Radio next Sunday right here on KTalk Media from 7 to 9 p.m.